I'm obsessed with people and the granular conflict that they have, which is often petty. I love petty.
I love petty too. It's the drama, Mick.
It's the thing that we go to bed thinking about late at night of what did she mean by that? Or should I have said that? And so I love to tap into what makes us think those things.
With thanks to Bailey's, this is the Women's Prize for Fiction podcast, celebrating women's writing, sharing our creativity, our voices, and our perspectives, all while championing the very best fiction written by women around the world. I'm Vic Hope, and I am your host for season 7 of Bookshelfie, the podcast that asks women with lives as inspiring as any fiction to share the 5 books by women that have shaped them. Join me and my incredible guests as we talk about the books you'll be adding to your 2024 reading list. Today, I am joined by writer, academic, and author Kylie Reid. Kylie's debut, Such a Fun Age, was an instant hit, making the New York Times bestseller list and, probably more excitingly, selected for Reese Witherspoon's book club. Despite this success, in her 20s, Kylie had always thought of her writing as just a hobby, turning to other jobs such as nannying and sales. And it wasn't until she was accepted onto the Iowa's Writers' Workshop that she began to give her writing her full attention. It was here she discovered how uncomfortable writing about money made other people, a topic that comes up in both Such a Fun Age and her new book, Come and Get It, which is sitting pretty in front of me right now. Come and Get It is out now in hardback, and it follows the lives of 3 women on a college campus and discusses topics such as class, race, age, and money. Her writing has been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Playboy, The Guardian, and others. In addition to writing, Kylie teaches at the University of Michigan, where her classes focus on driving plot through dialogue and the rules writers invent in fiction. She's a true believer that shape-shifting in fiction is a necessity. And Kylie, it is a joy to have you join us today. Welcome to the podcast.
That was a very nice intro. That does not always happen. Thank you so much for having me.
It's okay. I know sometimes it's a bit uncomfortable sitting through an introduction to yourself.
It's like when someone sings happy birthday. Yeah. You just have to kind of, you know, take a deep breath.
Clap along.
Exactly.
Do you find that your writing influences your reading influences your writing? Obviously, you know, as an academic and teaching every day, you're surrounded by literature.
Right. I definitely think reading influences my writing more often. I think that a lot of my projects are just a conglomerate of the things that stuck with me most that I just read. This novel, Come and Get It, was the direct effect of 3 very specific books that I read. Some of them I sought out, some of them I stole from my husband's shelf, and they just really stuck out to me. As far as what I'm writing going the other way, I don't think that what I'm writing will lead me to something. It's kind of the other way around. And I read so much student work and also thesis projects and starting novels, and those really inspire me to take a red pen to my work more often. So yeah, everything filters through the same kind of lens.
That's interesting. I never thought about the fact that you are actually consuming so much brand new writing through your students. And that has to be quite an inspiring thing.
It's neat, especially because whether they're graduate students who are very close to publishing their own books or undergrads who are STEM majors who just need an art credit, I definitely find myself saying, ooh, this isn't working. Do I do that? Let me take a look at my own thing and make sure I'm not making the same mistakes. Yeah.
I said in the intro that it took a while for you to realize that writing could be your profession and to find that voice. But were you a big reader growing up when you were a child?
Oh, yeah. I loved reading. Yeah. I think so many authors are always filling up notebooks and just think this is my private thing. Were you a Goosebumps fan?
Yes.
I think I had 70 of them. Oh, I loved them.
There was the Goosebumps books. There was also the books. Can you remember where you could choose your ending?
Choose your own adventure.
Yeah, yes. Choose your own adventure. See what happens next and next and next.
Mm-hmm. I have like specific memories of having my itty bitty book light in my bed with me in the Choose Your Own Adventure as you're snooping around. Yeah, they were just like magical. I read them all the time. Those and there was a veterinarian named James Harriet. Okay. I used to read all of his books. I have no idea why I was so obsessed with them. Anything I could find. I was a big reader when I was little, for sure.
I remember the feeling of reading those Choose Your Own Adventure books and thinking to myself, oh my gosh, imagine if real life also would have a knock-on effect depending on the decisions you make. And then it turns out...
It does. You're onto something.
I was onto something. Imagine if you did something and then anything could happen off the back of that, and then it changes the whole course of your life. Oh.
That's actually quite sweet, because when you're a child, you don't don't really understand that you have free will and choices as much because you're told to do so many things. So it's kind of a nice entryway into that part of life. Yeah.
To unstitching the conditioning that's being built around you. When do you get the chance to do most of your reading? Because I can imagine, you know, you've got a little one as well, that life is busy.
Of course, yes. As far as my personal like pleasure reading, I do look to Audibles now. That was not a thing I did before. When I entered the world of nursing, I thought, okay, I need a hands-free reading experience. And it was actually kind of sweet because it felt like my daughter and I were listening to certain books together in a certain way. And so that was nice. But you fit it in wherever you can. I used to think the life of a writer is so routined and orderly, but it's truly, if I'm in the car and I have 10 minutes, if I have a spare hour, just fitting it in wherever I can. Yeah.
Yeah, fitting it in is, I feel like, something I'd frowned upon up until quite recently. I thought, I've got to really respect the piece of literature here and I need to give it a good amount of time. I need to put an hour or half an hour aside. And actually, it's precious little drops and I'll take them where I can and it doesn't make it any less.
Right. Life is so busy and I feel like we're all working way too much. And maybe one day my life won't be filled with so many emails or other things, but that's where we are right now. And I think respecting a season of life is fine. If most of my reading comes hands-free when I'm doing laundry, I think that that's fine.
Then fair enough. Well, we're going to explore those precious little drops and where they fit in your life right now. Your first bookshelfy book is The Factory by Hiroko Oyamada. Beyond the town, there is a factory. Beyond the factory, there is nothing. Within the sprawling industrial complex, three new employees work. One shreds paper, one proofreads documents, and another studies the moss growing all over the expanse of grounds. Over time, little by little, the margins of reality seem to be dissolving. Where does the factory end and the rest of the world begin? What's going on with the strange animals here? And what am I doing here? The Factory is a vivid and sometimes surreal portrait of the absurdity and meaninglessness of the modern workplace. Now, you describe this book as deftly towing the line between real and surreal. So what is it about this that has appealed to you?
This is a fantastic novel. And I enjoy any book that can correctly portray work-life culture and also like anyone who does the real and surreal at the same time really well. I was so fortunate to interview Hiroko Oyamada about her book, and she talked about how she was a temp and she started writing this book while she was temping, and how the day's monotony was just so intense that it felt like, wait, am I here? Have I always been here? No, I am the workplace. It was this line that was being crossed in a really interesting way. There's something about the factory, too, that it pumps out to its workers that you are lucky to be here. At least you have a job. You're one of the lucky ones. Okay, now go and do these pointless tasks. And I think that that's really emblematic of a lot of different work, especially when you're in your 20s trying to find your footing. It's a beautiful novel. And the inclusion of animals is really haunting. There's birds that circle overhead in a very ominous way. And yeah, she just knows what she's doing when she's talking about work culture.
Why is work-life balance a theme that you're so fascinated in that you want to explore? What's your relationship to that term?
I think it's a farce, truly. I don't think that we have true work-life balance within a class society. There is something that's been happening, maybe I'm just aware of it, but I feel like in the past 10, 15 years, we see so many offices having an open floor plan and free cereal, and you can do this here. And I used to work in an office that offered haircuts to the employees, which is disgusting. It is, I had to clean it up. It was so gross. There were massages offered, and oh, we have this on the weekend, and if you stay late, you can get dinner. And it was as if they were trying to morph people's daily lives into their work. And those were the people that you hung out with. There was no differentiating between life and work. And I think that that's a very scary place to be in. I think that it is totally fine to not have an intense passion and to just go to work because you want to earn a paycheck and exercise your passions at home. And this tendency to say, make your whole life here is a really terrifying place to me. Yeah.
I remember when they got showers in one of my workplaces and thinking, what do you mean by this?
Right. Is this my home?
What are you saying?
Yeah.
And it's something that can be instilled in us in such a young age. They had showers in the library at uni. And I remember so many of my friends would just sleep there during exam term. And it's telling us that there is no balance. This is your life, which is scary.
Exactly. And people benefit
yeah.
from making it
and
their
lives. And it's
not
us.
No. And I feel that even just the community that happens when you stay late and you're having a drink, you may talk to someone you don't normally talk to. And then, oh, you're promoted because they didn't know you before. Mm. And I think that pressure is incredibly toxic and something we see all the time. It was something that I used in Such a Fun Age yeah. as well. Amira has a date, but her boss offers like, oh, do you want to have a drink? And I think that when that work-life balance is infiltrated, you feel like, well, I don't want to lose my job. I don't want you to think I'm not a warm, fun person. So I feel the need to do this. And I think it creeps into what can be like really beneficial me, you, family time at the end of the day. Yeah.
How old were you when you read The Factory? Do you feel like that had an impact on your reading experience?
I read it. It was during COVID, I think. I read it on the plane when I was on tour for Such a Fun Age. So I was 32. And I had my office jobs in my 20s. So it was nice reading it after those and being able to look at those with more of a clear vision. So perhaps, and I definitely want to write about work often. And I was working on Come and Get It at that time as well.
And what's your relationship with work now? Because as a writer, I'm sure, you know, it's a passion. So those lines can be blurred. Has that been something you've had to consolidate yourself?
It's probably morphing every day. The process of writing a novel is so different on both ends. In the beginning, it is so personal and intimate. And it's just you and the words. And as much as I love talking to people about art, it does feel like the practice is like the antithesis of creating it. I think so many writers deal with that, where they're very good at being alone and then they're pushed into talking about their work in a critical way. And it's definitely not easy. I think that it depends on the season. Having a daughter, I've become good at the phrases that they used in my old office was time boxing. So I feel like I'm good at saying, okay, I really want to clean my office, but I need to spend time with my daughter. I'm going to give myself 2 songs to do as much as I can, and then I'll go from there. So my balance is okay. I'm probably a messier human now with the daughter, but my balance is all right.
I think messy is good, to be honest.
I understand. Yeah.
The second book that you've brought today is The Walmart Book of the Dead by Lucy Biederman. Inspired by the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead, this darkly comic incantation on the gods and scourges of the 21st century contains spells to preserve the spirit of the deceased in the afterlife. In Lucy Biederman's twisted tale, shoplifters, grifters, drifters, hustlers, desirous children, greeters, would-be Marxists, wolves, and circuit court judges wander Walmart unknowingly consigned to their afterlives. Now, rather than a novel, as I said, this is a book of spells, which is so brilliant. Can you tell us about it? Why is it one of your favorite reads?
It's even just you reading it makes me want to read it again. It's so wonderful. I was writing Come and Get It, which takes place in Arkansas, and Bentonville, Arkansas, which is 45 minutes away from Fayetteville, is the home of Walmart. That's where that came to be. And Walmart and the Walton family definitely has a stamp on Arkansas and so many buildings and jobs and a lot of the culture there as well. So I was ingesting everything Walmart and trying to get inundated with the world of Arkansas. I'm not a huge poetry person, but this book really, really captured me. It just lived by the side of my bed, and I would read a spell or two before I went to sleep. It's beautiful. It's about money and buying things and desire and pettiness. And I love reading about normal people just making their way through the world and figuring out what makes them so extraordinary. It's a beautiful book. And I used a line from the book as the epigraph for Come and Get It. And I reached out to the author, and I'm happy to say she's such a kind person and we're friends now. So it all came full circle. Yeah.
What was it about that line that really spoke to you?
The line, I almost want to read it.
Can Please do.
Okay, this is the epigraph at the beginning of the book. I don't want to spend the eternity with the lights off. I'll buy the most expensive, longest lasting bulbs and charge them to my Amex. There was something that evoked the entire feel of the book. I wanted to write about consumption, desire, youth, and things. And Lucy Biederman definitely shares my view of the nightmare of buying things. She and I had a conversation about the terror of wanting a plain pair of black pants. And I think that that's a bit symbolic of the vibe of my book as well. So yeah, I was thrilled to find that passage.
As we said before, Come and Get It is out now, hardback. What can you tell us about it?
Come and Get It is about three very different women who all come to Fayetteville, Arkansas in order to get three very different things. Millie wants to be an adult. She's a second year senior. She's very responsible and she's definitely marked by hustle culture. Agatha Paul is a visiting professor and she's had a breakup with her wife, Robin, and she's looking to get over it and have a bit of a free, I can do whatever I want year. And Kennedy is a very lonely transfer student who has a secret. This is a novel about desire and buying things and what we do in our rooms when we're alone.
This and Such a Fun Age are both concerned with class, race, age, and particularly money. And you weave these intersectionalities through your characters so subtly. What is it about these topics that sparks your curiosity?
I have to be honest and say I never start with the topics.
Okay.
I never start with the big theme. I'm obsessed with people and the granular conflict that they have, which is often petty. I love petty.
I love petty too. It's the drama, Mick.
It's the thing that we go to bed thinking about late at night of what did she mean by that? Or should I have said that? And so I love to tap into what makes us think those things. So I start with characters. I'm very interested in the limitations that a world puts on characters, and money is a big limitation all the time. I think my interest in money is honestly more of a stylistic preference. Whenever I'm watching a movie and they're saying, oh, this thing is so expensive, I'm like, can you just tell me how much it is? I just want to know the number. And whether I think it's a lot or a little, it doesn't really matter. It would just help me color the world a little bit. I like to know exact details. And so I think the combination of wanting to have very normal people include exact limitations results in, especially within contemporary fiction, results in a talk about race and class. I think if you have black characters, characters dealing with money, all of those things are going to come out.
I'm always so interested in how Americans perceive class because it's a very different thing over there to hear in the UK. What do you observe about class in everyday America?
I think, you know, especially after doing so many interviews, I just hear class in so much language from, oh, he comes from a good family, she goes to a good school, or that's a trashy outfit. I see the class distinction in all of those phrases now. Class rules our lives and who we date and where we go to school and what jobs we get. I think as a working adult now, I understand how much more class is involved in your career path rather than anything else. I believe that hard work is great and that you can have definite benefits from it, but I also believe that where you come from has a bigger effect on where you go in life. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And do you think there's a dichotomy between being a writer and having money? I mean, there's two quite distinct images of authors that seem to exist now. You have the penniless writer in the garret versus the sort of superstand brand author.
Mm-hmm. I think money has a huge effect on if you can write or not. Writing requires so much brain space and patience and bringing your hand doggedly back to the page over and over again. And you need stability to do that. That's why so many people, myself included, try to get an MFA, because that's what it gives you is time and space. And so I think that there is this romantic notion of like this poor starving artist from like what, the 1600s. And I understand where that came from. But I do think that most of the literature that we see is from people who had the finances to write. Yeah, money makes writing and taking risk a whole lot easier.
Yeah. And it's something we see across the arts. Baileys is proudly supporting the Women's Prize for Fiction by helping showcase incredible writing by remarkable women, celebrating their accomplishments and getting more of their books into the hands of more people. Baileys is the perfect adult treat, whether shaken in a cocktail, over ice cream, or paired with your favourite book. Check out baileys.com for our favourite Baileys recipes. Let's talk about your third book now, which is The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. This is near perfect, in my opinion. Nobel Prize-winning author of Beloved, Toni Morrison's debut novel, immerses us in the tragic torn lives of a poor black family, Pauline, Cholly, Sam, and Pecola, in post-depression 1940s Ohio. Unloved and unlovely, Pecola prays each night for blue eyes like those of her privileged white schoolfellows. At once intimate and expansive, unsparing in its truth-telling, the bluest eye shows how the past savagely defines the present. Now, I understand you listened to the audiobook of this one.
Which she reads. It's incredible.
How do you think that impacted the way you experienced the novel?
It haunted me. Mm-hmm. It was both good and bad. I listened to it when I was nursing, sometimes in the middle of the night, and I would go back to bed and I truly could not sleep because her voice was in my head. It might be a perfect book. It's so incredible. And there's so many little details from the little girl who calls her mother Mrs. I can't remember what her last name is. It might be Robinson. But then the girls that the mother babysits call her a sweet pet name. There's so many little instances like that of just real world class dynamics being put to like a tender emotional place. It's truly a perfect book.
Like yourself, Toni Morrison addresses the intersection of race and class. Do you think that literature helps to move the needle, or that writers have a sort of moral duty to address issues affecting society if it matters to you?
I have a hot take on this.
Oh, I love a hot take. Please hit me.
I don't think it's an author's responsibility to have a moral standing within a novel. Not everyone needs a novel to entertain, and I understand that. I want a novel to entertain. I want it to keep me turning pages. That's why I pick up a book. But I'm also entertained by things like great depictions of normalcy, so everyone has a different layer there. I think it's a really romantic notion to think that authors are capable of changing minds through fiction. I personally don't like when a novel tells me what to think. I'm like a 16-year-old girl, and that, like, if you tell me what you think, I'm going to think the opposite. Don't do that. But I also think that the novels that rest on my heart and make me change the way that I think about the world are just true and just present facts and data to me in a really plain way. So as much as I would like to believe that authors can change the world in that way, I also don't want that responsibility. I want the responsibility of just presenting truth, which also takes a lot of bravery on the page.
It does. I've always said that the reason one of my favorite authors is one of my favorite authors, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, is because it's philosophy without philosophizing.
That's what I want, yeah.
It's socioeconomical facts that mm-hmm. I can then process, and my moral compass will work out what it needs right. to work out based on my feelings towards that fact.
I think that that's probably doing more than telling you yeah. what they think, especially because when I want someone to tell me what the world looks like in that way, I go to nonfiction. I trust that information much more. Within fiction, I am looking for a more curated, entertaining read, and layering authors, particularly Black authors, with having a moral standing as well. Yeah. I don't want to do that.
And it's sort of imbuing them with a responsibility that isn't fair.
I think so too.
Always. I know that, you know, growing up, my mum always pressed the novels of Black authors in my hands just to give me a bit of perspective on the world that I wasn't maybe getting from where mm-hmm. we grew up. And I'm always like looking to them to have answers because they have to represent me mm-hmm. and they don't mm-hmm. have to represent me.
Right. They can tell you their opinion yeah. and you can learn something new or not. But at the end of the day, I don't think authors should be held responsible to insert morals into their storytelling.
Gadi, do you prefer an audiobook, or is it just, you know, necessity dictates that that's the way that you're consuming at the moment?
Pure necessity. I love sitting down with a book and doing my own, you know, voices in my head. Yeah. But unfortunately, for the time being, it's Audible books for me. But it has actually brought me to books that I wouldn't have read otherwise. I now have favorite Audible readers. Dion Graham is my favorite. He does all of James Baldwin's whole canon. Eduardo Ballerini is another one of my favorites. So now I seek out books that I would have never looked at before because of who's reading them.
That's so interesting. Yeah, that voice now changes what I'm going to, you know, go for. And you mentioned as well that you listen while nursing your daughter. You've got your hands free then. Mm-hmm. How do you think motherhood has changed you? I'm going to say first as a writer, because we'll move on to a book where I'm going to ask you about how it's changed you as a reader.
Got you. Okay. As a writer, I mean, the timing is just different. It's so funny, in graduate school, you're like, I have no time. You had plenty of time. Yeah. It's so different. But I have to say that I think being a mother, I feel consistently maybe 80% happier in my life. And so I'll take that joy and put it into my writing. I think that everyone is different, but for me, having a child made me compartmentalize things a bit more correctly. And if my daughter is happy and healthy, then I should just write about whatever I want and take bigger risks. So she has made finding time to write so much harder, but my life so much more joyful, I would say. Yeah.
It's a really beautiful way of putting it. What do you think you would or could be doing if you weren't a writer?
If I wasn't a writer, I do love teaching a lot. I hope I would still continue to be teaching. To be honest, I would be just fine being a stay-at-home mother. I love being a mother. I love the tediousness and watching my daughter grow. I would have no problem staying at home with her and just making sure her days were really full and exciting. What else would I be doing? There's so many things that I would love to do, but I would be terrible at. You know what I mean? I was a cheerleader in high school and I loved gymnastics. I could not be worse at it. I'm terrible at it. So I don't know if I could be some kind of ambassador for the gymnastics world. That's what I would be doing. What would you be doing if you weren't doing this?
Well, I remember being asked when I was very young and what I wanted to be. And I remember answering J-Lo. And
that's a great answer. She's a great job.
I was like, just J-Lo, you know, triple threat.
There you go.
But yeah, look, I mean, thinking about it now, it's the same thing. There's obviously a difference between the things I would love to do but wouldn't be good at. I'd love to be a gymnast. Can I do gymnastics?
Right,
no.
Exactly.
But probably working for a charity, mm-hmm. I imagine, in the charity sector.
There you go.
But here we are and we're doing it.
Exactly. This. Yeah, this is pretty good too. Yeah.
And we're talking about your next book, your fourth book, Shelfie Book, today, which is Either Or by Elif Boutman. Celine is the luckiest person in her family, the only one who was born in America and got to go to Harvard. Now it's her second year, 1996, and Celine knows she has to make it count. The first order of business to figure out the meaning of everything that happened over the summer. Unfolding with the propulsive logic and intensity of youth, Either Or is a landmark novel. Hilarious, revelatory, and unforgettable, its gripping narrative will confront you with searching questions that persist long after the last page. Tell me why you picked this book.
I loved this book so much. And I think, did I do the audible? Yes, and it was very good. Oh, I think the author reads it. I'm very into the authors reading their own work right now. It is such a clever, wonderful book about the musings of a young person as she's growing up in college. I like a lot of plot, and I wouldn't say this book has a ton, and it doesn't matter. I could stay in this person's head forever. There are pages where she just has musings of music, and there's now songs that I can't listen to the same way again without thinking of the book, and it's always in a really great way. It's a really beautiful novel that has a more accurate depiction, I believe, of what coming of age looks like. It's not so romantic, and it's really extraordinary. Have you read it?
I haven't. So this is a book recommendation for me.
It's really great.
I'm like making a mental note to put on my list.
It's a continuation of the characters from The Idiot, but you do not have to read The Idiot to understand it. It's really well.
Yeah, I've got written down here, notes, I liked this better than The Idiot.
Yes, I did. I did. The Idiot was very good, but there was something about this one that really captured me. Yeah.
Well, this book and Come and Get It, they both take place on a university college campus. Mm-hmm. What is it about that setting? And I totally think that it makes such a good backdrop for a novel. Mm-hmm. And not just novels. I mean, look how many movies.
Right. We're obsessed with it.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a weird theory about this. College campuses, particularly in the United States, are the one time when Americans can live in a walkable utopia like community. You can go to a grocery store, go see your friend. You can go to change your major or go to an improv group. There's so many options right there where you're at. And I think that after college, we're swept into the workplace world where we have a 45-minute commute in a car and then we're tired and that's it. It's just this college is just like this little paradise, I feel. You're also coming and bringing all of your values from home and then having them challenged in a gentle way because you're just meeting new and interesting people. I do think colleges are a lot like a shopping mall in that they're very shiny and look to offer this promise of a brighter future when that's not always available and everyone's coming at college from very different socioeconomic backgrounds. But there is something about the urban infrastructure that makes it seem like anything is possible on a college campus.
It's true. After that part of your life, your world does get at once bigger and also smaller, you will do less on a day-to-day basis and things are physically further away. I was discussing just the other day the sort of the pros and cons, because as university gets more expensive and life gets more expensive, kids are having to weigh up, do I really want to do this? As opposed to it being kind of a given rite of passage that it used to be. And I said to my partner, because he didn't go and I did, I said, you know what it was? It was prime friend making mode, because that doesn't happen again in your life. You're never surrounded by so many people, like you say, who can maybe challenge things that you're thinking, but offer you opportunities to think in new ways. They're all just there, laid out for you in this like sort of weird microcosm.
They all want the same thing as well. Everyone's searching for different connections. That was something that I wanted to mess with in Come and Get It. For one of the characters, Kennedy, she comes in just so crippled by the idea of how to make friends, but and it seems like everyone already has friends to her. And there is so much available. There's so much choice that kind of cripples her. But for some people, that's where they take off and make friends that they keep for the rest of their lives. Yeah, it's very fascinating.
Oh, my God, that fresh is fair. When you've got all the stands and the stores and their free pens and all the different things, you could be joining the societies. And I found it so exciting. It was like the world just opened.
All of these shared resources that are like, you know, someone's great grandmother paid for some library that you just get to go sit at. Yeah, it's an amazing time and really complicated for a lot of people.
Well, let's talk about music in this book.
Yeah.
I think you said Lauryn Hill's songs have completely changed now because of you thinking of this book when you hear them. Why do you love that aspect of it?
There's a section that is so genius, and what the character goes into her analysis of Killing Me Softly by Lauryn Hill. And it's a great lesson in doing more than one thing at a time. It's a way of looking at a song differently. It's identifying the character's characteristics, and it's also taking you through what's important to her in the story. And I always think that fiction should be trying to work on more than one angle, not just plot, but emotion and character at the same time. It's just really clever. And I don't know if I've seen music analyzed this way in fiction before, and I hope I see it again soon.
Yeah. Do you listen to music while you write?
No, I don't. I keep it really quiet. Yeah. All quiet. Sometimes I'll go on rainycafe.com and put that on just because I need some background noise. Yeah. But no, no writing, no music. Yeah,
it can be difficult. Some writers absolutely love it. They find it really inspiring, really helpful. And others, it's a huge distraction.
Yeah.
I know that during the UK sort of exam period, study leave, the number of 15 to 25 year olds who listen to classic FM goes up by like 50% because they just want music
that
with no lyrics.
Right. So they can have something there, but not everything. Do you listen to music while you work?
I would listen to like very minimal, maybe tech, house, something without lyrics. I would find that too distracting.
Yeah. I think I would too. I think I try and save it. I take a lot of breaks when I'm writing, like every hour and a half, I try and get up and go for a walk and I save the music for later. It's like, if I work through this, you get to listen
it's
to the
treat.
Music. Yeah, exactly.
Do you have any other habits when you're writing other than putting on The Sound of Rain?
I do wear headphones, even though nothing is playing from them. It's a nice symbolic, you're working now situation. Other than that, no, I try and exercise my eyes and make sure I'm taking my eyes up and out and looking out the window. Just doing whatever I can to get it done that day. It's pretty simple. Yeah.
During that writing process, where in your mind is the pressure, especially, you know, let's talk about the fact that Such a Fun Age receives such a positive reaction from readers and from critics, then you move on to Come and Get It, your second novel. Do you feel the pressure to write another successful book? Is that in the back of your mind?
This might sound crazy, but I did not feel that pressure in the way that I thought I would. I had a thesis professor who's wonderful tell me, you already did the big book. You did the big one, it did well. Now make this the book that they never would have let you write before and just have no expectations from it. And that was really freeing. So thinking that you've already proven that you've done a big book makes you say, okay, I'm gonna take the risk that I wanna take here. So I've just been pretending that this is like my acoustic album that's just for me this whole time. I do like a little bit of pressure. I think the great thing about the success of Such a Fun Age was more understanding that there's going to be a canon. And my agent, when I was signing with her, said, I don't wanna just be there for the great ones. I wanna be there for the smaller ones, more experimental ones, if you wanna do something different. And so I'm starting to see the future of my work a bit. And so I didn't feel like a crippling pressure with this one.
This is your Joanne
Yes.
Lady Gaga's Country album after she'd managed exactly. to tell everyone, okay, art pop, you got what you want.
Yeah, now I'm back to me. Exactly, yeah.
It's time to explore your fifth and final book, Shelfie Book, Sleepy Time by Gyo Fujikawa. I love that we're taking a slightly different, a little twist, a little turn, slightly different route here. Baby's yawning, baby's bathing, baby's sweetly slumbering. Day is done and it's time for bed in this classic book. Fujikawa's gorgeous illustrations contrast the children's nighttime rituals with the horse that sleeps standing up, the lazy sloth that snoozes upside down, and animals that doze the winter away. For parents and children alike, this book is a lovely way to say goodnight. Tell me why you picked this.
All right, let me tell you something about children's books.
Yeah.
So many of them are terrible. So many. And like, you're reading them all the time. My daughter loves to read. And so I think it's important that we're all, you know, getting a little bit of enjoyment out of these things. So many children's books are just telling her to behave a certain way.
Mm.
And she's so little. She's just learning about the world. And I want her to just be filled with ideas right now and not anyone telling her what she shouldn't do. Fujikawa's books are so beautifully drawn, but they're also like a bit of a fever dream. There's not a clear through line. It's just, hey, this is what we do when we go to bed. Oh, look, there's a horse that's also going to bed, and some animals sleep in the day. Isn't that crazy? The end. And I really love that frenetic but calm energy. We have three of her books. My daughter is obsessed with all of them. These are the books that I give to friends when they have babies. I really love her work.
I can imagine, obviously, you read a lot of children's books these days. As you say, some are terrible. How has it been coming back to these?
You know, there was a book called The Monster at the End of This Book. And I remember reading it over and over again when I was two or three. And it's about a Sesame Street character who says, don't turn that page. Don't turn that page of The Monster at the End of This Book. And I remember being so scared as I was reading it. I don't know if that book created my entire personality, but that is truly the feeling that I want to give people when they read my book of, I know something's coming and I don't know what it is. And so it's been fun to revisit books in that way. But of course, my daughter has different interests than I do. And it's just, it's neat to see where her brain goes.
Is there something that you look for in particular when you're picking books for your daughter? You said there that you just want her to sort of know that the world is spinning.
Mm-hmm.
Things
right.
are happening.
Right. I'd love for her to see just the way that people can look differently.
Yeah.
She's very into animals right now. And so that's really important. Anything that's like visually stimulating in a way that's calm. I feel like a lot of children material is really big flashing lights and neonists to keep her attention. I want her to just feel like she's in nature almost when she's mm-hmm. looking at a book and just see new ideas on the page. Yeah, I don't think I would ever write a children's book, but I have very strict opinions about what makes a good
yeah.
children's book, and I don't think it's easy to do.
Well, it's totally fair enough. I mean, what goes in is going to have a huge effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we must never underestimate that. I took a break from social media recently and from just my phone in general and was just in nature for about a month. And came back and looked at the headlines and realized that it's no wonder I was so stressed and often depressed because I'm being bombarded.
Oh, yeah.
And it's important to know what's going on in the world, but no human being can possibly conceive of the magnitude of some of these things that I'm seeing on my tiny screen. It's a lot. And imagine you're a baby and mm-hmm. you've got all of that going in. It's important what you put in.
100%. Well, now that I have her too, I want her to understand what it's like to be bored or to just be able to focus mm. on something. And you're totally right. When you're on your phone, it's like you're saying happy birthday. There's a war in this place, or maybe you should buy this. And it's all in the same place coming at you so hard. So I'm also impressed by your dopamine detox that you went on. I'm considering doing the same. But yes, of course, she's going to make her own decisions and be a human in the world for right now when she's so little. When it comes to her books, we just want her to be able to discover new things on a page on a different read that aren't being flashed at her in a really dramatic way.
It's probably a little while, but how do you feel about the thought of her reading your books?
Oh, that's so interesting. I don't know if I've ever even thought about it because she's so little. I hope she would be entertained, but I would totally respect her saying, ew, that's my mom's, that's gross. Like, I like reading books, but that's too close to home. Yeah.
And Kylie, where would you like your writing to take you next?
I want to do something different with every book. So of course, I think most writers are always working in their brains, but I'm going to be a little bit coy about the next one as I'm excited about it. I want to try new things with style, character, delivery, tone, and yeah, we'll see what happens. Give me a few years though, because it takes a little bit to write with a baby this time.
I'll hit you back up. Perfect. Few years time.
There we go.
We've had quite a spread. I mean, we've had, you know, this beautiful children's book, a book of spells. I mean, if you had to choose one book from the list that you've brought today as a favorite, which would it be and why?
All right, I think I'm with you with The Bluest Eye. It's okay. It is just such a testament to a vision. I am of the belief that as a writer, it's a chemical like makeup of your brain and the way that you see the world. And this is just a person who is just her body and brain lends itself so naturally to storytelling in an incredible way. Bluest Eye is also a hard book to read. Mm-hmm. And there's so much trauma and sadness in it. And wanting to go back to a book like that, I think, is a real testament to the author. It's truly a perfect novel.
And of course, you read it as an audiobook, read by Toni Morrison.
It did.
She feels sort of imbued by her.
Mm-hmm. There were so many moments where I thought if I was reading it just by myself, I would not read these lines as well as her, and I would not get the full body of them. And it's also funny in moments. There were many moments that I laughed at that I would not have done if I had read it by myself. She knows what she's doing.
Well, I think if any of our listeners have read it, which I'm sure so many have, it's maybe worth going back and,
I think it's
and
worth
taking
back.
It in that way now.
Truly, yeah.
Oh, Kylie, thank you so, so much. I've got some excellent recommendations to take away from
them.
This.
This has been so lovely.
It's
thank
been
you.
Absolutely gorgeous to get to know you.
Me too.
I'm Vic Hope, and you've been listening to the Women's Prize for Fiction podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Bailey's and produced by Birdline Media. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.